What I want to do today with all of us here is I want to have an informal dialogue between Colleen and I. I'll be asking some questions, kind of moderating, that introduce more advanced work. According to Gary Nixon, it would be stage two work, specifically in the lower left-hand quadrant, looking at the relationship, the relational domain. And so what we've done, John, you have a sense of it because you were able to join us last Friday. But Guy, what we've done for the first 2 weeks, the first week we started by looking at by introducing the lower left-hand quadrant and talking about Nixon's three stages, and then introducing a vignette of a hypothetical couple that would be like a couple that any of us would see in counseling, where you have somebody who's, in this case, the male of the couple is very early in recovery. They're coming in with all kinds of on the one hand, relief for his being committed to recovery. On the other hand, a whole backlog of relational, you know, betrayals and disappointments and lies and all the rest. And so what we did that first week is we unpacked that together, and it gave a chance for everyone present to share their insights as well as for us to share personal observations, what we've learned. Victoria has a background in her studies in marriage and family therapy and has been practicing as a coach, Victoria? Is that fair to say?
Yes.
Yeah.
That's what I'm calling myself.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Similarly for me, my background, I've taught a lot of courses in marriage and family therapy, and very few of them addressed addiction and recovery. And in the addiction and recovery world of treatment, there tends to be, at least in my experience, a fairly superficial understanding of the complexities of marriage and family systems. And so both domains are lacking a dialogue. And so what Colleen and I are attempting to do in our book that we're working on, we've entitled it Plural Recovery, is to bring in a in-depth look at the lower left-hand quadrant and specifically gauging it across, kind of gauging the assessment and the treatment across the domain following loosely Nixon's stages of what does working with a couple look like in stage one? What are the issues at hand? I introduced in the second week looking at the neurobiology of stage one, specifically looking at post-acute withdrawal syndrome and what you might expect in the brain of the recovering addict in early recovery. And most of the literature that I've read around PAWS or post-acute withdrawal syndrome located that you can count on it being having maximum impact from the first 6 months right through, oftentimes right up to about 2 years. And so there's a lengthy period of time in there where, unfortunately, a lot of marriage and family therapists and other treatment professionals have intervened trying to heal substantial wounds, what the program calls wreckage from the past, in a relationship where you have one individual, namely the addict in recovery, whose brain, hence relational capacity, is seriously compromised and kind of on the way towards recompensating. So we talked about stage one and what can be done in stage one. I won't review all that today. We have our archived material from that, but we looked at that in depth last week. So the first week, we introduced the territory with a vignette to kind of flesh it out. The second week, I dove deeply into stage one and what can be done by both individuals in the couple. This week, what we want to talk about and introduce, at least, is looking at stage two, where there is at last the possibility of a brain, both brains, ideally, being enough, having enough biological integrity where you can begin to address the really repairing the ruptures, or what Colleen will talk about here in a few minutes, the attachment injuries that go right to the core of the security of the relationship and have a tremendous amount of impact, as we discussed last week, have a tremendous amount of impact on the sustainability of recovery. The number one trigger for a relapse is stress. And the number one stressor for most individuals is relationship stress. So you can kind of do the math and see that without addressing the relationship, particularly over the long haul, and today we'll be looking at stage two, that long-term recovery is really imperiled. And so that's really where Colleen and I are going to be focusing in our book together. Just a word about Colleen, and then I'll introduce our conversation. Colleen, I think most of you know that most of my work is in academics and has been over the years, and I do some recovery coaching, but it's a minority of what I do. Colleen, on the other hand, is a full-time therapist, and I think I'd like to move into a conversation with her by just asking her a little bit about the work you do, where you work, and a little of what you do. And then we'll get more into the specific content. We just made it
okay. So, can you guys hear me?
Yes, fine.
Okay. Not used to this. I want to make sure you can hear me. So, I have two practices. One in the in two different places in California. So, I've got two private practices where I see lots and lots of couples. I also see families and individuals, but the bulk of my practice is couple work. And then I also work at a treatment facility for, I would say about 35% of the people at this treatment facility. It's both residential and also outpatient. They have day programs, and it's a really wonderful treatment center. I'm really, honored to work there. Lots of really great clinicians and people from just the best clinicians from the LA area, and this treatment center provides help for people with a lot of dual diagnosis, but also, you know, just general mental illnesses like bipolar, you know, mood disorders. They have a very sophisticated OCD clinic on the premises, and they do all kinds of just about every modality you could imagine. So I specialize there in the family program, and they have a great family program. So I work with couples and families doing interactive teaching, multifamily groups, and also counseling with families and couples. And then I also work at a clinic in Newport Beach that is an outpatient recovery clinic, and that is for alcohol and substance abuse, and it's a day treatment program, and I do like mindfulness kinds of groups there. So that's the bulk of my work right now. So a lot of work with couples and families.
That's great. Thank you, Susan. Thank you. I have basically just four questions to kind of talk into today. As I mentioned, Colleen and I just gave a 3-hour workshop yesterday morning here nearby at a local university addressing forgiveness in therapy generally, and we actually had a sustained or long enough role play that involved forgiveness in a couple where there had been an extramarital affair. So that was the content around which we centered yesterday in terms of the application. But the material that we presented on forgiveness is rooted, especially from Colleen's presentation, it is rooted in attachment theory. And I'd like to just ask a question about that. First of all, if you could maybe comment on just maybe two or three of the kind of central contributions, let's say, of attachment theory to therapy. And then I'll be more specific in a few minutes to ask maybe if we can look at how that arcs over into the application of attachment theory as a perspective on both diagnosing as well as treating, how that applies to working with addiction treatment.
Sure. Okay. So attachment theory, probably a lot of you are familiar with attachment theory, or at least you've heard about it. And it's basically the study of how we grow, develop, and change within the context of a relationship. So what it's doing is it's recognizing through a lot of very robust research and study over, I don't know, about 4 or 5 decades now, that we are wired for connection. We're social beings. And so there's a lot of kind of Western cultural ideas about how independence, you know, it's a sign of health and so forth. And it's not that being, you know, independent in ways is unhealthy. It's just that we didn't realize the depths and the reality of how we really are wired for interdependence. And in attachment theory, interestingly enough, they don't really look at anyone as being over-dependent. They don't really call it that. Instead, they look at effective dependence or ineffective dependence. And effective dependence is when you, it actually is that you are stronger together than you are on your own. So the more securely connected you can be to another person, the more autonomous and independent you can be. So there's a level of health that is developed through a healthy interdependence that's really recognized now and verified, you know, through research. We can see it across the board in terms of just not only mental health, but physical health. There's a gentleman by the name of Bert Uccino out of the University of Utah who's done a lot of study on adult relationships. So back to attachment in general, I'd say almost three decades of study on adult love relationships. Whereas before it was mostly between infant and caregiver, now we really have a lot of study and research on adult love relationships. So this guy, Bert Uccino, out of the University of Utah.
That's your neck of the woods, John and Pam. And Heidi.
He says that the best predictor of health, that a good relationship is the best predictor of health. And he says that it's also the biggest predictor of mortality. As well as mortality against specific disorders like heart disease. There are studies out that emotional isolation is worse for your health than smoking or not exercising. So there's so many ways that close connection, it's also really the biggest predictor of happiness in so many studies. There's a wonderful documentary out that I suggest you watch. It's for the lay public, but it's very well done. They've got some really heavy hitters on there, and it's called Happy. And it's a kind of an inane title, but it's called Happy, and it's I think it was out in 2009, but you can get it here in the States, like on Netflix. And that talks, you'll see a lot of what I'm talking about echoed in that documentary. So I don't know if that gives you kind of
That's
enough
great.
Background.
That's great. Any questions about attachment theory more generally? I imagine all of us have had our encounters with it, and some of us have read more in depth, but just any questions for Colleen at this point, and then we'll move into looking at applying some of its insights generally to addiction and recovery.
No questions, but I appreciated that introduction because I didn't really know anything about attachment theory that was that clear. So thank you for that.
That's great.
No, it's really good. Thank you, Colleen.
That's great. Well, let me ask then, as in the spirit of our conversation yesterday, how you see attachment, what does it have to add to what we already have in existence in terms of perspectives on addiction and treatment?
Yeah, Bob, can I ask a question? I mean, you're probably going to get here, but I just want to make sure it's covered because I would imagine that a lot of our clients and our students and our patients, I want to say that are suffering from addiction have had a history of ineffective interdependence or good connections with their primary relationships.
Yeah.
So how do we work to overcome that and to heal that vacuum or that wound?
Let's let that be kind of the central question arcing over our entire presentation. It's a great question, John. And we're headed in that direction for sure. Right now, kind of looking at attachment theory, kind of laying out the foundation or the backdrop, and then more specifically going into what does this look like in coaching and counseling, working with the addict and his or her significant other. Absolutely. Where does the rubber meet the road? What does that look like? And we'll get there, John, I promise you. Okay, great question. Okay, any thoughts about attachment theory just as an additional perspective on addiction and treatment?
Okay, sorry, I was with John's question. Now let me switch gears. So on addiction and treatment, any questions?
Mm-hmm. There are books, for example, out that are looking at addiction as an attachment disorder. I'm just wondering any kind of general comments.
Yeah, well, wow. There's, I kind of straddle between two cultures or worlds, you know, in my therapy kind of, because I'm a member of like five different organizations, an active member of like three of them. And so I am active in the addiction community. So I really rub a lot of shoulders with you know, treatment professionals and people who run clinics and that kind of thing through an organization I'm involved in. And then I'm also very actively involved in another organization that really focuses on couple and family, most specifically couple relationships. And it has very advanced training in that area. It's an organization and a orientation called Emotionally Focused Therapy for Couples.
I've mentioned that, and so, we talked about that in the first couple weeks. They have a little bit of an understanding of Sue Johnson, but a very
right.
cursory.
Okay,
very cursory.
That's fine. So, yeah, so these two worlds aren't really talking much to each other, and so there's a lot of implications for people who are in recovery with the complications like you're mentioning, John, just in relationships in general. I think that in my whole practice, I can't think of one client or couple or family I'm working with that isn't struggling with relationship issues as really mostly their central like issue. I don't know, maybe I just happen to get those clients. So, you know, it could be because that's what I specialize in. I don't want to, you know, not look at that, but it's certainly that is a really big issue. And people who are in the addiction world don't know the nuances of couple work. And in fact, most of the population really doesn't understand how to work through difficulties and ruptures in the relationship. None of us really. I mean, I happen to know just because I've gotten training in it. But case in point, I was working with a couple just this week, and the guy says, it was a heterosexual couple, and the guy says to me, Does anybody know this stuff? Like, are we supposed to know this? He was just, he was flabbergasted because he said, I feel like my head's going to explode. That's what he said in session. He said, because he thought he was doing things right the whole time, and he's finding out now from his partner he was getting it wrong. And he's just throwing his hands up saying, oh my God, I didn't know any of this. And so I have a lot of couples that I work with and families that really don't know how to navigate these really sensitive issues when they come up. So then you couple that with someone who's in recovery, and not only they're just getting back a sense of self or even trying to formulate a sense of self, they also are still vulnerable. They've had years where they've shut off their emotional kind of capacity, or they've shut down they're sort of arrested in development in some ways, you know, through the addiction because things were shut down and not dealt with. So you're dealing with this backlog of maybe they've been using for 10 years, so they're sort of 10 years in arrested development, plus there's all this stuff that they haven't worked on, plus they have no idea how to work on it. So I think it's a really loaded issue when you're dealing with someone who's in recovery. And when you have, I hear on my listserv, I'm on a listserv, and I hear questions posed sometimes from the people that work with couples saying, I don't know why we're not getting any progress. You know, this guy, he goes to AA, and his sponsor's saying, don't talk to his wife. And they're saying, how can you have a good, robust relationship when you can't turn to your wife? And they don't really understand the implications of what that is. So both ways you're getting, that's kind of the impetus behind our book and what we want to get out there, Bob and I, is because I feel like from what I've seen, there's a big gap in.
Let me add something to this. We discussed this in the last week or two, is that there's an ironic missing here. We talk a lot about this at IRI, is that the 12-step program, with all of its virtues, has at least in my direct experience in AA, in Colleen's experience in Al-Anon, has not particularly evolved to address the last 75 years of progress in looking at lower left-hand quadrant research and theory. And so just to be generous about it, I'll put it that way. And so you have a program that's kind of an anachronism in terms of, in fact, if you studied psychology in the 1930s or 40s, you wouldn't have had access to the forward movement that you see only really beginning in the 60s and 70s with the family systems theorists and so on beginning to introduce the necessity of looking at psychopathology in a larger way than just what's going on inside an individual's skull. And so the 12-step programs are missing that, and with all the value in the 12-step programs, it stands to reason that it would be additionally of value to integrate these findings. But the flip side of it, and this is ironic, as Colleen and I talk about this not infrequently, is that we'll hear of family therapists, couples therapists that are really advanced in terms of their understanding of what's going on within the, let's say, the couple's dynamic, really, really skilled, and and be nearly, let's say, be superficially acquainted with the realities of addiction. Really not understand what's going on in the addictive process. And my own bias is, especially in the advances in the last 10 or 15 years, which we talk about, and John, you talk about in your book, and Guy, I know you're fully aware of it too, is looking at the strides that have been made in understanding the gross and specific impact of addiction on the brain. And most therapists generally, including marriage and family therapists, are minimally acquainted. One course in graduate school 15 years ago isn't going to suffice. And so you see also a kind of naivete coming from the therapeutic community that is in the context of family or couples therapy, intervening with kind of a disregard out of ignorance, a disregard for the implications of the addiction process and how those will influence marital communication, relationship repair, and so on. So it's really both ways. There's kind of all of us could stand to be more in dialogue.
Yeah, yeah, I totally agree with that. Mm-hmm. And it's a source of real sadness and, I don't know, frustration for me, because I see, you know, like Bob was saying, there's some really gifted people that I know of that work in both realms. And then I see these big kind of just like missing something really huge that is really key. And so there's just, especially from the AA Al-Anon kind of culture perspective, because it was really developed during a time when attachment theory is not integrated into that model, really. I think there's some brilliant things about it, and there's some great work to be done for both parties, and 12-step can offer so much for so many people, but then there's a place where it really does not address at all. And I hear people in meetings, you know, really struggling with relationship stuff and being at a loss.
Let's open it up to you guys. Any observations, questions, criticisms, witticisms? I know John will.
No, you know, I don't have witticisms, shockingly. But definitely a comment, and I just think this is really great, and I think that probably the weakest part of my my book and my stuff is probably the lower left quadrant. I'm always called into that, and I just kind of wing it, you know, intuitively when I have to work with families or couples. But it's definitely not my specialty, and you know, in the integral, you know, intuition is that. Everybody's right in what they affirm, but we err in what we neglect. And John, so I think it's important. What's that?
Yeah, I have a thought here, John. We talked about this last week, too, and I remember reading your book. I've read your section on working with families two or three times now, and it was also helpful for you to remind us last week. I wanted to ask you a question, John, to see how this lands. I like the material that you present in terms of the work that you did through Wilderness Recovery and how you bring families together. And my thought was, it takes me a while sometimes to gather my thoughts. My thought was that what you're suggesting makes a lot of sense in early recovery, to initiate the conversation between one member of a couple and another, or a father and his son, a mother, daughter, and so on. I really like that, where it lays the beginning kind of foundations of beginning to move towards each other in terms of airing resentments and making requests for behavior changes, et cetera. If that's accurate, and you can correct me on this or fill it in more, if that's accurate, that was my impression as I heard you talk about it, kind of through this perspective, is that the next piece, which is I think what Colleen's implying here, the next piece of going into more in-depth work, that's the piece that comes next. And that may be a piece that Colleen's and our contribution may add to what you've already done in terms of laying some foundational structure. Because I think stage one work has got to happen in order for stage two to take. And so I thought about this later. Now, does that resonate for you, John?
Well, yeah, absolutely. And if you don't do stage one, you don't have the foundation to enable go on to stage two. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I'm very, very excited, Colleen. You're doing a great job, by the way. It's really compelling. And, you know, I'm pretty much a upper right, upper left kind of guy. You know, that's where I'm best in. So down the left is like...
Well, we can't be in all quadrants at all time. I don't know if that's possible, John. But I, you know, I appreciate your saying we can't specialize in everything. There's just not enough of us to go around. And so I too, you know, like you, John, am always...
Hello?
Oh dear, we just lost Bob and Colleen. Huh.
So we should stay on?
Yeah, they'll be back, I'm sure.
Better be.
Hello?
Hi Bob, we lost you, but hi.
So sorry about that. Are we all still here now?
Yeah.
Okay, great. Yeah. Colleen wants to finish this point, if it's possible.
So I was just going to say, I appreciate, you know, John, you speaking that way, because I really feel like there's so many areas. You know, when I'm talking about attachment and I'm saying, you know, it's kind of the central tenet of everyone's existence, I also recognize that there's other really, you know, big topics that are really central to people's lives. So, you know, I creativity, you know, finding your own, whatever your gifts are and developing those. There's so many important aspects of life, you know, in different quadrants that cover different quadrants. So that this, but I often, what I see is that there are so many people that are suffering and unhappy because they're in bad relationships, or they're not in a relationship, or they're in a relationship and they don't want to be in that relationship. So.
Yeah, and the intuition is, I mean, an integral that any pathology or any stress in any quadrant negatively affects all the other quadrants. And on the other hand, any good work you do in support and health in any quadrants also supports in a good way all the other quadrants. So this works together. But as integralists, we have to realize what we're really good at and say, but I need help in this because this is not my specialty, and bring the team together that we need to get the job done.
Yeah. Something that we have going on here, I think, John, which I just absolutely love about our community, is, for example, I'm thinking of Guy, your new book and your work has such depth phenomenologically, and I don't want to reduce it to one quadrant, but just to say the specialization that you bring just in that kind of phenomenological existential domain, John nor I, neither one of us can match that. It's a huge contribution you're making. Colleen and I ideally will bring this specialization. And John, you brought a map to all of us, but you continue to go in depth your way yourself. And so it will go for us. So I love your support. Really appreciate it. And I feel like that our diversity makes us the stronger. Yeah.
If I can maybe, thanks for the feedback, Bob. If I can maybe add something to that.
Yes.
Yeah, although I tend to focus on those things, and I think we've had this conversation often, is I always believe the lower left quadrant is actually the most important quadrant for addicts in recovery, especially the first couple of years. Although the other practices are, you know, equally important from a practice point of view, but I think the quadrant that indicates sustainability in for somebody's recovery, if they have that quadrant sort of pinned down properly, the lower left quadrant, the relational stuff, support, fellowship, you know, support from the family, friends, and all those things, that is, I think that's the big guns in a way. If those things are in place, then the chance of them, you know, getting better is much better, I think, than sort of practices in necessarily other quadrants. I mean, all these things work together, but I think also the idea from an integral point of view, whether it's upper left or upper right, all these practices are always mediated within the context of a relationship. You know, even if it's a relationship with oneself or with a practice or with the other person or the people you're doing the practice with, the relational aspect is the ground that all these things happen in. So, you know, whether it's upper left quadrant, it doesn't really matter. Relationship is always present at any given moment. And I think that's one of the wisdoms of of the 12 steps, why they place such an emphasis.
Guy?
Guy, you're just breaking up a little.
Just
a little.
Go back a sentence.
Sorry.
You said that you think part of the importance of the 12-step program, and then it got garbly. Can you repeat that?
Yeah, just in short. And I think that, you know, one of the main premises of the 12 steps is the whole relational component, that it always has to happen within a relational aspect. Otherwise, all the practices won't sort of glue together. So I really appreciate the work that both of you are doing, because I think it's an area that really is essential for integral recovery.
I really appreciate that point, Guy. It's interesting that you are singling out the first couple of years, which is, you know, are obviously in a big way the most fragile time, you know, when someone is making that huge transition. And I think that's true. I'm just sort of thinking about it kind of as you're talking. I haven't really, but I'm wondering if you could say a little more about those first few years and the crucial nature of it, from your perspective.
Well, maybe just very, very brief is, you know, as you were mentioning the attachment theory, and Bob, you were mentioning that, probably referring to Flores's book on, with the title Addiction
is
the Attachment Theory.
Yeah.
You know, I think one of the main etiological causes of addiction is poor attachment. The stress that people experience of giving up their primary attachment, which is drugs and alcohol, and I think attachment theory has a lot to say of the relationship people have with drugs and alcohol, because it's just it's also a profound attachment. When that attachment disappears, the need for attachment, I think, is one of the first and foremost needs addicts have in early recovery. And that attachment has to be replaced with a new and healthy form of attachment. So I think all the other practices and all the other methods needs to take place, you know, in an environment where attachment is considered absolutely essential.
Yeah.
For the internal resources to rectify itself, and, you know, all the new object relations and all those type of things to form in a healthy way. So I think attachment is just so essential that it's non-negotiable.
Thanks, Guy. You really articulated it very clearly. I think that's really in sync with the kind of the values and the perspective that Colleen and I are taking. Let me check in with Heidi and Victoria as well. Any thoughts from our two fine young ladies?
I'm just so appreciative of the interaction among all of you and what's being lifted up here. So I'm just paying rapt attention to what I'm hearing, and thank you all. This is very helpful.
Thanks, Victoria. We're all very attached.
Yes. Putting it into practice.
You're a missed sprinter, that's for sure. I love Guy and I love John. And they tolerate me. Heidi, how about you? Any thoughts or questions that you have at this point?
Nope, I'd just like to hear more.
Okay. I'll tell you what, we have about 10 minutes or so, and let's think about this for a second. I wrote a note to Colleen suggesting that we might move into the more technical application in another presentation. It really deserves, what does this look like? It kind of gets at, John, your earliest question is, what does this look like in practice? And in fairness, we can't do that in 10 minutes. I think what we've done here is established a conversation or a dialogue between this quadrant and the other quadrants in Wilbur's model, as well as within the various disciplines that come to bear in and around addiction and recovery, it seems to me a very apparent need for increasing dialogue. Colleen has a thought here.
Yeah, I have a thought. If I'm going to come back, I want to leave you guys with maybe something to think about, you know, over the week, that just sort of looking through a different lens, you know. So when I'm working with a couple or a family, there's all the content that's going on, right? But I'm always have this sort of like, almost like it's another harmonic where I'm looking at what's the attachment, what's going on from the attachment perspective. And you can almost see things. It's like you're, it's almost like when you're working like in analytic work and you're looking with dreams and you're looking at things symbolically. It's like you have another kind of way of understanding what's going on. So they may be saying, you never pitch in. You know what I mean? I'm always doing everything around the house. Okay, well, you could get lost in that content, but what's really going on in the in-between? What does this have to do with their connection, the we here? So my thought is, I want to run this, it was a pretty big study by you, and maybe have you cogitate a little bit on it over the week, and it could kind of set up things for the next, if I come back, and that is that, or when I come back, that is that there was a big study out of the University of Texas done. It was a 5-year study, and this corroborated a lot of other studies that were done, not exactly like this, but, you know, it was backing up of where the research was leading in terms of our understanding of certain basic tenets of attachment. And they looked at what is the biggest predictor of a successful marriage 5 years into it. So all of you start thinking, what do you think is the biggest predictor of a successful marriage in general? Does anybody want to toss anything out?
Mutual respect.
Mutual respect.
Okay.
Same. Trust, yeah.
Trust.
Guy, you want to...
Not really my forte.
Well, sometimes when I'm
living in separate houses,
a lot of people will throw out the bait, you know, sex, money,
rock and
communication,
roll.
You know, okay, the biggest predictor is emotional responsiveness.
Wow.
Emotional responsiveness. And in fact, this is what I see when I'm working with couples. Basically underlying most fights and arguments, you can boil down to these four kind of questions that are floating underneath the surface. Can I count on you? Will you be there for me? Am I valued by you? And do I matter to you? If these answers to these questions are yes, you know what? They can talk about the finances. They can talk about their differences in sexual preferences. They can talk about the in-laws, you know, and it's not that those conversations are easy, but fundamentally, if you really think about it, if those questions are a big yes, those are the marriages that tend to succeed. Those are the, you know, partnerships that tend to flourish. So it's this emotional responsiveness. And really, you know, if you're brought up in an environment, back to what you were saying, Guy, you know, if you're brought up in an environment where you had none of this modeled, you didn't have this kind of responsive, you know, be able to empathize, able to understand, able to talk through things. If you didn't see that, you weren't exposed to it, you didn't get it, how the hell are you going to be able to do that in your own relationships? On top of having to deal with kind of building yourself back up. So that's kind of what I'd love to kind of have you sort of just think on, like, as you're hearing people and they're griping about this person or that person, you know, it's kind of like I try and think of, where is the hurting place inside? Where are they suffering? And if I can kind of get to that and get to what they're really longing for, once we reach it, that place, and we can drop down to that place, we're at a whole nother level, and that's where the work really begins. So I don't know if that helps at all in terms of kind of framing up the steps and stages of what you want to look at or how to kind of work through. But I want to say one other thing, which is that the biggest problem I see with couples, in my own relationships as well, I mean, I'm speaking for myself as well as the clients that I see and so forth, is how to work through ruptures. How do we repair ruptures? And if we have no way to repair it, what happens is that distance, that cavern, that resentment, that, you know, we can't do this, gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And when you can repair those ruptures, the bond actually gets stronger and more resilient. And that's an amazing thing to see when couples are able to successfully work through injuries and difficulties, there's a kind of a confidence that's developed, which then can become a kind of what we would call earned secure attachment. So if you weren't born with secure attachment, which many of us were not, you can actually earn secure attachment. Doesn't mean that you're not going to default to your kind of like when you're under stress, you know, your sort of insecure attachment, but you can get earned secure attachment if you can really build a relationship. And if you have that, wow, that's a really robust foundation for health, I think, in life.
Mm-hmm. That's great. Thanks, Colleen. Let me ask all of you, since we're here, what would you think about our having a part two, even next Tuesday morning, where we look at more of what Colleen just talked about, where we look at it in terms of a couple that's in the process of recovery together, and look at some of the technical questions that arise. Would that be agreeable?
Yeah, as many parts as we need, you know, to get it done.
Yeah, I think that would be great. It's a mystery to me how couples, once the trust has been ruptured and things went haywire, you know, how do they ever get it? How can you ever retrust somebody if they've already sort of shown that they're not trustworthy? It's totally a mystery to me. I'd love to know some clues about that.
Yeah, Heidi, I really hear you, because in those moments, it looks so hopeless, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Yes.
And that's when each member of the couple is standing right at the edge of the cliff, right at the edge of the abyss, with their toes hanging right curled around the edge, and they're just right there about to tank. And it's they're both feeling hopeless, sometimes terrified. And that's when really I think that they need some professional help. And, you know, there's a huge range of professional help out there. So oftentimes they'll get professional help and it won't work. And what happens is when they can't work through that, like I was saying, their trust and their what it does when they don't work through it is it actually confirms the injury. They end up saying, well, you see, we're not meant for each other. I'm working with a couple right now that's going through this exact thing. You know, every time that injury is not repaired and it happens again, it just confirms that they shouldn't be together. But yet they still love each other, and they just don't know how to work through it. So Sue Johnson, John, did you want to say something?
Yeah, I wanted to say something. You know, from my perspective, I mean, doing that kind of work, if these people did not have an interior practice, you would be very much handicapped as how deep you could go, because oftentimes it's not just that injury, but it's tied to all the other woundings from childhood, from a previous relationships, from whatever, and it just connects to a whole bunch of past stuff. So if you can have people doing both the upper left and the lower left at the same time, then you're really in a, you know, then you really got some depth and some reinforcing practices that will just make the whole field much more open and successful, I would think.
Yeah, it's fascinating for me is that I'm in total agreement. And before I started to really deepen into this model that I'm working from now, I couldn't imagine how the hell anyone's going to make it if they're not doing their own work. But what I have been able to observe working from this perspective is that there's a way to work with these ruptures and repairs that actually gives the person an experience that helps them to work through things in a we context that doesn't necessarily necessitate that they have all of this their own kind of background. It's kind of hard for me to articulate in a short amount of time, and I'm really kind of still watching this unfold, but it's amazing to me. Like, I'll be working with a couple where, you know, like there's a couple I'm working with now where the guy has had he's had a little bit of therapy, but he has like his emotional sort of awareness is very limited, but he's learning by leaps and bounds. And this is the difference, is that there's so much at stake, John, in the relationship. And so oftentimes people won't go to the gym, they won't go do this, but if they're going to lose their relationship, that's what panics them. So sometimes for some people, not everybody, but for some people, that's actually the motivator that gets them to do the work. because that might mean that they're going to lose this person. And I think, you know, back to what you were saying, Guy, about how important it is in the beginning, I think that that's another huge motivator in the beginning. Like, they don't really want to get sober. You know what I mean? They don't really want to change their whole lifestyle, their identity, all of their friends. They really don't want to do that. But if they're going to lose their child, their partner, then suddenly that's a game changer. And then that gives maybe enough incentive and motivation for them to actually start embarking on the work. Mm. So it's interesting. I'm really watching this, and, you know, it's still evolving. I don't have a real formulated opinion about it, but I'm very open to just looking at all the different ways this work can happen.
That's great. Thank you, Colleen. It's been great having you here.
Thank you so much.
Thank all of you. Are we agreed that maybe next Tuesday we pick up on part two of this?
Terrific.
Absolutely. Yes, that would be great.
Hey, yeah. Let me give a little plug for the IRF. Lisa Holliday started the Integral Recovery Fellowship, and it's a great resource for any of us who have clients or students or whatever, and it's completely free. And people who are working on that level, at the Integral level, can't really, you know, get that met at a meeting. Just know that that's available, and it seems to be really dynamic and growing and very healthy. So it's a real super blessing that that's online now. So.
Shoot, we just lost Bob and Colleen again, so they didn't hear you, John. They clicked out right.
It's not the first time I haven't been heard. Trust me. So anyway, awesome. And I got to roll. Hey, Guy, good hearing you again.
Yeah, you too, man.
Okay, God bless.
Thank you all.
Yeah,
Heidi, I have a request for you. I know I have somewhere the information about the IR Fellowship. Would you be willing to send that out again?
Sure. Definitely.
Thank you.
I'd love to.
Yeah.
Bye.
I would really appreciate that.
Yeah, I'll do that right now. Bob, you just all John was saying was to plug the IRF Fellowship to all your clients and everything in case they would be interested.
Yes, yes. Okay, great. Did you all catch the last part of what Colleen was saying there? I don't know.
Yes, we got right through to where okay. Bob was.
Are we agreeable to aim for next Tuesday for part two of this?
Yes, everyone would love it.
Okay. Thanks a million, Guy, especially you at such distance joining us. John, it's been great having you.
You know,
Rhea,
Bob,
as always, Heidi, you too.
Thank you. Speaking of distance, Rona was trying to join us, but she couldn't get on Skype. It was too bad. I was emailing to her.
Well, hopefully next week. Thank you, guys. Great to engage with all of us here. Thanks a million.
Thank you.
Thanks for
thank
welcome
you
to Colleen. Appreciate
Colleen.
It.
Thank you. So great to have you here.
All right. Take good care. We'll talk to you guys soon.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.